Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, February 23rd, 2013. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. It was in his Friday webcast of a week ago, actually a week and a day ago, on Friday, February 15th, that Lyndon LaRouche laid out what can be seen as a kind of ultimatum based on his forecasting, that either we impose Glass-Steagall banking regulations now, or the hyperinflationary period which we have entered will destroy civilization. In the course of this last week, Mr. LaRouche has emphasized that up to this point, members of the U.S. Congress either don't understand this, they're too afraid to take on the status quo, or they're prepared to stick with those who created the crisis. A prime example of the latter, those who created the crisis would be, who are sticking to those who created the crisis, would be President Obama. But it's becoming more and more difficult to convince people that all is well, that the bailouts and the quantitative easing have worked, that there's no inflation, that we're on a slow but steady growth path. These are lies that are ringing hollow. And secondly, it's becoming more clear that the alternate proposal available, that of Lyndon LaRouche, beginning with Glass-Steagall, is the only plan which could work. Now, the passage of Glass-Steagall is only the first step, to be immediately followed by an American system credit policy and an implementation of great projects which will increase the energy flux density applied to our productive process, with NUWAPA and space defense as the first two immediate priorities. On our program today, we're going to look at what Mr. LaRouche is saying, beginning with that February 15th webcast, what he's saying about hyperinflation, about how this is the end of the system, and also about the drive by some leading figures associated with the British monarchy and the City of London for a massive reduction of world population, using the end of hyperinflation as the opportunity to move for this policy of genocide on the next level. Joining me today will be Paul Gallagher, who's been covering these areas of economics and finance for EIR for decades, and who is now increasingly involved in organizing the Congress, helping to get them to break with their bad habits of impotent capitulation to our nation's enemies. Also, if time allows, we will discuss the renewed impetus for a strategic defense of Earth following last week's asteroid flyby, which was expected, but was accompanied by a meteorite hit in Siberia, which was not expected. Paul also, years ago, played a leading role in the organizing of the original SDI of LaRouche through his work with the Fusion Energy Foundation. And as many of our listeners know, we're coming up on the 30th anniversary of Ronald Reagan's famous speech on March 23, 1983, in which he announced publicly his adoption of Lyndon LaRouche's SDI idea. So, Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Harley. I'm glad to be on.
Well, we've got a lot to discuss today, and I'd like to begin with Lyndon LaRouche's bombshell last week with his announcement, not that the hyperinflation was a bombshell, as you pointed out, that this is something that's becoming increasingly clear, but that a faction in the British monarchy is moving to let the system crash and introduce a new, highly restrictive monetary system in its place, one which would leave most people on the outside without jobs, without food, savings, pensions, any access to money, and so on. Now, what is it in what you've been able to look at on this? What is it that Mr. LaRouche saw that led to his conclusion that this faction is now preparing to dump the present financial system?
Well, I don't mean to be roundabout about it, and I'll try not to, but you have to say that, first of all, what he was making brutally clear in that webcast is that we can't organize the implementation of Glass-Steagall on the basis of the congressional view of it. If we do it, it'd be nice if we do it now. If we don't do it now, we can do it next year. We'll take another look at it, etc. This is not something which will work in that way. Since, in particular, since that webcast, there has been a much greater seriousness around the country on just how urgent Glass-Steagall reenactment is. There are now seven states in which the legislatures are considering resolutions demanding that Congress pass it, demanding that their state, their federal representatives from their state introduce it, sponsor it, pass it. And in a number of these states, many representatives from the state senates and the state houses have signed on to these resolutions. There's real pressure, upward pressure there, which we're organizing.
Well, the most recent was South Dakota, where you had over half of the, actually 50 out of 70 members of the House of Representatives and half of the Senate.
Yeah, it's practically the whole place now. Is demanding three very refractory, two senators and one congressman, very refractory types from South Dakota, being put under real pressure by their legislature, which is predominantly Republican, and of which almost all have signed on to the demand for Glass-Steagall. It's got to be done in that way because what LaRouche was establishing is either do Glass-Steagall immediately, or we will cycle very rapidly from burgeoning hyperinflation caused by the runaway printing of money by the Federal Reserve and other major central banks in the world. And on top of that, you have a galloping policy of austerity being imposed in particular all across the European continent, completely on the surface of it, completely ineffective, failed policy of austerity. The more it's applied, the more debt there is, both public and private and bank debt in these countries. And that this kind of failure is not so accidental. In particular, the IMF has given indications that it understands that it's imposing a failing policy. It's doing so deliberately on these countries. In and around the British monarchy, who are committed to reduce the world's population and have been for decades and decades, you have commitment to a policy that they understand fails. That is, it burgeons the debt. It makes the need for printing of currency to try to pay that debt worse, to the point where the policy snaps instead into a deflationary austerity policy. The history of this from 1920s Germany is crystal clear. And, you know, when the equivalent of the Dawes plan comes in, and all of a sudden the currency, which has been hyperinflated and relatively destroyed, is suddenly replaced by a very scarce currency, backed by this kind of international lending combine around the IMF, as it was in Germany then. Then you get suddenly extreme deflation, in which that currency does not go around. Only the wealthy, the large corporations and banks really have access to it, and everybody else is suddenly fighting to survive, fighting to live. That is what happened in 1920s Germany, and we know what it led to.
Well, Paul, let me just bring something else up in this context, because what Lynn pointed to that last Friday was that the opposition to Glass-Steagall is coming from precisely these networks, and that at the same time you have a debate that's going on throughout the transatlantic on banking separation. I think one of the most interesting cases is that of Great Britain or the United Kingdom, which has now officially gone into a triple-dip recession. They've done exactly what you said, the austerity policy, which is not working. It's not doing anything to improve the economy. And at the same time, it looks as though they're going to go with an even more hyperinflationary bailout policy.
Yeah, the battle is really on in Britain, because there are some human beings there in the population, probably a lot of them, and some sensible people who are pretty well informed in the parliament clamoring for Glass-Steagall. One poll of the entire House of Commons, which was done by the Financial Times newsletter, Financial Times paper, which itself is campaigning for Glass-Steagall. That poll showed that 60% of all the members of the House of Commons wanted the U.S. Glass-Steagall Act by name imposed in Britain. And the government was pushed into introducing legislation, which is kind of a pale echo of it, but goes much further than any other government in Europe or the United States has gone. So you have that reaction to what is otherwise a combination of extreme money printing from the Bank of England. Remember, they started it at the time of the Los Cabos summit of the G20 in Mexico early last year. It was the Bank of England was first, which first said unlimited money printing. That was followed by the ECB and of course, the Federal Reserve with this QE4. Bank of England started it, and at the same time, the government, the Cameron government, has imposed really strict austerity policy, which has plunged the country into, I mean, they call it a triple dip, but that implies that there were times when they were not in recession. It's really a four and a half year long contraction of the economy. And so the result is they can't, their debt has been undermined. It's ballooned, just like in Greece and in Portugal, the debt has ballooned. Yesterday, they were downgraded by the Moody's ratings agency, and they responded, the government responded by saying they're going to double down on the austerity, which is causing this. So you see, you've got a policy here which is not being pursued rationally in our sense, but rather from the standpoint of just contracting economies and contracting the population, eliminating, that's what LaRouche was pointing to. This leads to simply a lurch from extreme hyperinflation into deep deflation and depopulation. And we better get Glass-Steagall through, because it puts an end to the first part of that, which is the money printing by the central banks. It ends that with a screeching halt. And then we can move to credit, and we can move to recovery and infrastructure investments. So since he said it, it's become pretty clearly understood around the United States and among the people that we're talking to. And it really has produced movement, particularly, as I was indicating, the state legislative movement and so on, really has produced a change. Then there was the bombshell that came from this very large bond investor, PIMCO, the largest bond investing company in the world. They have not their CEO, but their chief loudmouth, you would say, Bill Gross, came out with a real bombshell 10 days ago, where he simply sounded off on the fact that this policy of austerity is producing galloping increases of debt in every major country in the world, that debt is becoming more unpayable. And the way he expressed it is that the governments are having to print, to put into circulation, more and more and more currency and more and more and more debt in order to get the same change in GDP. And that this had gone from being a 4-to-1 ratio 20 years ago, that is $4 of new debt for $1 in new GDP, to a 20-to-1 ratio. And he, as he said, he wasn't even counting the shadow bank, the derivatives and so forth, the shadow parts of the banking system. And so as we calculated it, what he was talking about is really more like 500-to-1 at this point. It's an out-of-control debt spiral. He called it a credit supernova, meaning a worldwide blow-up. Putting it that bluntly, has also had a shock effect in terms of the oncoming of this hyperinflation. Hello? Well, I think... Hello, George, you're there, right?
Yeah, Paul, I'm here now.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I got cut off a few minutes ago, so I know you were discussing the British situation when I got cut off. So
yeah, and I also indicated the shock value of what Bill Gross of PIMCO put out, the credit supernova that he put out 10 days ago, in terms of, you know, Lynn making this deadly serious and therefore getting people into action that they weren't in before.
Well, on this question of people seeing the hyperinflation coming, you and I talked about this before the program. There was a very interesting report from the Federal Open Market Committee discussion at the end of January. Obviously, there's a debate going on within the Federal Reserve. We see this with Richard Fisher. We see this also with the former Kansas City Fed chairman, Honig. But obviously, there's questions about the viability of continuing with the quantitative easing. And also this question of, can you ever get out of this? What happens to the Federal Reserve? And I wonder if you can shed some light on that.
Well, the Federal Reserve, there's been at the last two meetings of the Federal Open Market Committee in December 12th and then January 29th, where they discussed the policy of printing money currently running at $85 billion a month by the Fed. There was growing alarm. It grew considerably from December to late January among the members, the Fed governors and presidents of the regional banks, growing alarm that they're printing so much money, they're buying all the securities that the banks have to offer, and they're getting into a situation where they will never be able to turn around and start to sell this huge asset book off. It's going to be by the end of this year, more than a quarter of the entire GDP, the Federal Reserve's asset book, all of it acquired from banks in order to put liquidity and capital into these banks and make it possible for the banks not to write down all the toxic securities they've got on their books.
Now, I just want you to repeat that, because this is something that always comes up. People are saying, well, where's this money going? The Fed's putting this out there. Besides the TARP, there was TALF, there were all kinds of programs, overnight loans. Much of it is just sitting in the banks or on reserve at the Fed for the banks, precisely to keep them from having to write down assets. Isn't that right?
Yeah, a very dramatic chart was published 2-3 days ago on an investor website here. On the breaking down the assets of the U.S.-based banks, the larger ones, not only the real big ones that everyone knows about, but also a lot of the larger regional banks. And to make it short, taking the four or five biggest, the Bank of America, the J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Citi, taking those, they have now on their books, although they're supposed to be commercial banks, they have as many securities, as large a value of volume of securities as they do loans. It's basically roughly 30-40% loans, 30-40% securities, and the rest cash. And the reason, and none of the other banks, the large regional banks, have anything like this kind of cash. The reason these huge banks have 20% of their assets in cash is that the Fed has been printing and money and buying securities from them so that they can have that huge cash cushion in order to protect themselves against the devaluation of their otherwise toxic securities.
It's a kind of insurance policy for them.
Yes, and it sticks out like a sore thumb among these five or six of the biggest banks that the reason they're not lending, the reason all this money printing and the money is going into the banks, the reason it's not resulting in lending is they're holding on to it to protect against the losses that they know are there that are coming in the next crash.
Now, Paul, just to take this further, even with the cash they're holding, it nowhere begins to cover the obligations they have from their derivative holdings, right?
Yes, this does not. These percentages I was talking about do not take into consideration the value at risk that these banks have in their derivatives holdings. So, you know, they are They are hedging against immense losses, and regulators will admit this to you. That's what the banks are basically doing against instead of lending, despite the Fed pouring this money into them and the Bank of England and the ECB and the Swiss Central Bank and now the Japanese Central Bank heavily doing the same thing. So at the FOMC meeting, the participants are clearly becoming alarmed that if the Fed keeps doing this for more than a few more months, it will not be able to stop, because as soon as it tries to stop, interest rates will shoot up. That will grossly devalue the securities that the Fed itself has been buying, and it has such immense volumes of them that it will wipe out a serious chunk of the Fed's own capital. And keep in mind that the Fed is a bank and that it is a very, very highly leveraged bank, certainly in excess of 50 to 1, unlike any bank you know of. And that will mean either that the Treasury has to come in with a large amount of new capital, that's taxpayers' money, bailing out the Fed, or that the Fed will react to an attempt to stop printing by having to lurch back and print at an even greater rate than it was doing before in order to cover its own insolvency. That's what a central bank will do when it suddenly finds itself insolvent. It has the authority to print, and it will do that. So,
and that's where Mr. LaRouche made the point that there's no way to cover this debt. There's no way, even with printing, that if you have a so-called derivative explosion, or even something slightly bigger than what J.P. Morgan went through a year ago, you risk having all the value of all the securities being held called into question. And at that point, even with the flood of money that the Fed has out there, you can't cover it.
Absolutely. And the other thing that the members of the Fed committee were obviously alarmed about in these meetings, and they talked about many of them. They don't give the names, but many of them were alarmed about this, was that this money they're printing is going into the very rapid growth of the same bubbles that collapsed 5 years ago.
And then in spite of this recognition, you had Bernanke at the G20 meeting in Moscow this last week praising the quantitative easing policy. As we mentioned before, Mervyn King is escalating it. This is what Draghi is doing at the European Central Bank. And now the Japanese appear to be doing something similar with the loosening of the purse strings there.
Yeah, it's out. I mean, the resistance now is something that Bernanke, in particular, is having to fight. In fact, there was an item in Bloomberg yesterday in which they had been told by sources that sometime during this month there was a conference in New York at which a leading economist, Lawrence Mishkin, who used to be in the Fed, gave a presentation on precisely what I just went through, indicating and warning about exactly what I was just describing, the Fed's own asset book and these bubbles of junk bond investments, of so-called leveraged buyouts, which you wrote up, Harley, recently,
yeah,
of the collateralized debt obligations, the other forms of derivatives. These bubbles now growing at an even more rapid rate than they did in 2006, 2007, before they crashed. Although they're not as big as they were then, they're growing at a rate which is even more rapid. Mishkin went through all this, according to the sources that Bloomberg had. And Bernanke then, since there were a number of Fed governors and presidents present, Bernanke got up and had to dismiss it and counterattack it and so forth and say nothing like this is going to happen. So you could say that the cat is definitely out of the bag, and hyperinflation as the policy of the Fed is now, there's open season on it. There's open recognition of it. But obviously what LaRouche was saying is we have a different, we don't take pot shots like that. We have a different strategy entirely. It's based on the welfare of the nation and of the other nations of the world. We say this is the consequence if you don't do what we're already fighting for, which is the immediate imposition of Glass-Steagall bank reorganization. It's not a regulation. It's a reorganization of the banks. If you don't immediately impose that and then go on to making the economy grow with national credit, this is what you will get, and it will be followed by, you know, and I think people need to understand that historically, the clearest case of this in the 20s in Germany, this is exactly what happened in 1923 as a whole. And then in 1924, the opposite happened. And the Dawes plan, the international lenders came in with a large loan from J.P. Morgan at that time, or raised, organized by J.P. Morgan, which was the basis for a new currency. And that currency, and also the French were induced to leave the Ruhr in order to relax the austerity ever so slightly. And then a Morgan man, a partner, was put in charge, became the czar of the German economy. That's what we would call it today. Mm-hmm. I forget his name. He was a very young Morgan partner, which infuriated the Germans even more because he was only 30 years old. And he essentially started a policy for the rest of the decade of austerity, which was just brutal and deadly, and led to the uprisings of the Nazis in resistance to it, in opposition to it.
Well, now, Paul, when you go into the Congress, and I know you've been doing some meetings, and our listeners should know there is a renewal of the bill from the last session by Marcy Kaptur. It's now H.R. 129. It's got, what, 15 co-sponsors so far. Mm-hmm. But when you go in and meet with these congressional offices and discuss with them this hyperinflation question and the split, the alternative of hyperinflation, either a collapse of the hyperinflationary bundle or a deliberate default, a deliberate breakdown, versus Glass-Steagall, are you getting a recognition from them that, I mean, is there more of a sense in the Congress now that this is taking place, or are they still living in the land of fiscal cliffs and sequesters?
I think there's a lot of indications in the way that members of the Senate are behaving, in particular that they know they should be, they know their staff should be meeting with us, and they should be listening to what we're saying. The battlefield is one in which the deck is really stacked to make this very difficult to do. The White House is very strongly against Glass-Steagall, and they all know it. The Wall Street, of course, is even more strongly against Glass-Steagall and is using the White House and the Treasury against it. And they all know that. You know, people like John McCain, who are a little crustier, say it publicly. You know, that Wall Street is too powerful to get Glass-Steagall through the Senate. That's what he says both publicly and privately. But at the same time, he says, I'm absolutely ready. I'm a sponsor. Just, you know, as soon as a Democratic senator is ready to go with this, so am I. So they know the way we put it to them is that you are facing deep austerity. It's coming at you from the White House and also from the Republican Party pushed by Wall Street. Deep austerity. This is going to be devastating because it's going to be combined with hyperinflationary money printing by the central bank. And that's a recipe for hyperinflationary explosions and collapse. And you had better stop it by moving now with a policy which only starts with Glass-Steagall. Then you have to replace all the credit, which is disappearing. You have to replace that with national credit so that the nation is investing in large-scale employment, in modern infrastructure platforms, in real productivity. And that means NWAPA, that means a number of other things. But you have to start the fight to defeat this inflation plus austerity policy by implementing Glass-Steagall. That gets you going. That closes one door to the Fed. It stops the printing. And it opens the other door to actually recovering the economy. So that's the way we put it. And, you know, there are not many who deny it, but we're having a fight with quite a number of people, particularly on the Democratic side, who want to defend the Federal Reserve. And they want to say that the only reason that we have any quote-unquote recovery in the United States, which they imagine we do, and they imagine it by comparing it to the European countries, right? So the only reason we have that, they say, is because the Federal Reserve has been so loose and has helped the stock market go up. And this has helped us out. So don't attack the Federal Reserve, because they're our only hope. It may sound strange for the rest of the country, but that's a good part of what we're fighting against.
Well, you're listening to Paul Gallagher from the Executive Intelligence Review. We're discussing the comments made by Lyndon LaRouche at a webcast a week ago, and that he's continued over the course of the week, about the shift or the moves from a hyperinflation into a possibility of bringing down the system and a move to a different, more restrictive monetary policy. And Paul's been referring to the 1923 Weimar hyperinflation. Now, Paul, we do have the bill. What can the listeners do to make sure that we get some action on this? Because it is the case that one congressman or one senator could force a hearing on this, isn't it?
A really dedicated, really mobilized senator could. What we're trying to do is get what they call policy briefings held on the whole policy. Glass-Steagall, national credit, NOAPA, infrastructure, get the whole policy to reverse this thing, to get not hearings, but briefings, which can be much more effective when they're held and both members and staff can come to them. That could obviously be done, but what we have going now, and anybody listening can get in on this immediately, is people are writing letters and to their members of Congress and to their state legislators, and sending us copies of those letters. And people who are mobilizing with us are going to the state legislatures, which, this being the time of the year, many of them are in session right now. And, you know, they get things done while they're in session. They have a short time, and they take actions while they're in session. They adopt budgets and so forth. They go to their members of the state legislature and get them to write letters to the congressmen who immediately represent that area, and give copies of those letters to us, because obviously in Washington, we present the letters and make sure that they are seen and that the pressure is actualized in that way. And this is leading in many states to the resolutions that I was describing earlier. But it doesn't even have to do that if you have people who they recognize at the state level as elected officials and activists are funneling the pressure on the members of Congress through us, through the LaRouche Political Action Committee, because that's what makes it really effective. Everybody there knows we're Action Central on Glass-Steagall. So when it comes through us, it has quite an effect. Some of the ones that have been active already, like in Maryland, have already had quite an effect on the elected officials from that state.
So our listeners should get on this case right away. And one of the places they can go is to the LaRouchePact.com website on the Glass-Steagall page, which will give you some of this information on this. Paul, let me just move to something that's related to the austerity question quickly, and then I do want to get to the strategic defense of Earth and for the last 15 minutes or so. But the sequester is now looming as part of the enforced austerity. You know, the president, who actually was the one who came up with the idea of the sequester in the first place, is pretending it's the fault of the Republicans. I'm not 100% clear on this, but it does appear as though this will have a very dramatic impact in areas including especially defense and defense-related technology areas, as well as government. What's your sense of where we stand on this and what effect it would have?
Well, it's already been having that effect. There was a contraction of the U.S. economy in the fourth quarter of this past year, and that's continuing because there are layoffs going on constantly, particularly on the defense side of the cuts. These layoffs are not waiting for March 1st. In the Pentagon, for example, there have already been about 45,000 layoffs, mainly of contract employees, temporary employees, but they're people who are working full time. In an economy like ours, this kind of across the board sudden cut has a big austerity impact, and it's already been having it because, especially with large contracts which are involved, both defense and non-defense contracts, the companies which have them start to lay off as soon as they see the prospect of these cuts coming. And we were writing about this already in September, October of last year. It's really when those layoffs started to happen. So then you have to understand that it's very clear that the White House strategy, Obama's strategy, is to, in stages, replace these cuts, that is, let them get started, but then quickly replace them with much larger cuts in the entitlements, in the Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid entitlements, on which primarily the older generation are living. Also cuts against the hospitals, clinics, and other medical healthcare firms which are providing these services to, particularly to the elderly and to the poor, are themselves being threatened, with the objective coming from the White House, which is just much larger entitlement cuts.
Well, I noticed in the last week that we've seen again the ugly faces of Simpson and Bowles reemerge with another proposal still for cuts. And so you see the austerity knife looming larger and larger.
Yeah, Simpson and Bowles are really Wall Street talking. They didn't give up when their own commission failed. We called it the cat food commission because of what it was going to reduce people to. Even its own members wouldn't recommend its own report to the Congress. But Simpson and Bowles have kept going with Peterson Institute and other Wall Street funding. Very clearly, they have spawned a series of various named organizations in order to keep themselves going. I call them Obama's golems, because he created them. Then he wanted to distance himself from them for the last 6 or 9 months, but they have kept trudging along, lumbering along in the direction of disaster. And this week they surfaced again in Washington in a big breakfast and called for another $2.5 trillion worth of cuts and tax increases, mainly by eliminating deductions that almost everybody uses, like the mortgage interest rate deduction, another $2.5 trillion worth of austerity on top of everything that's already been done between now and 2020. And they meant real serious cuts in medical services, Medicare, in Social Security, raising the retirement age even further, lowering the benefits, and so on, and then other cuts across the board in the discretionary budget. So,
there's a higher irony here, which is that during the last presidential campaign, one of the things that was tossed up from time to time is we don't want to end up like Greece. And yet you look at the policy, the fact that the International Monetary Fund itself acknowledged that they were wrong in prescribing that the austerity would not affect the real economy. And yet they continue to push the policy. And this, I think, is where we get to the other side of what Mr. LaRouche is discussing, which is that most of the debate that's going on is a complete fraud, and it's a cover for killer austerity combined with the destruction of the idea of an energy flux-dense economy, moving increasingly towards the kind of green policies that will not allow the population to sustain itself. And I'd like your thoughts on that before we move into the SDE.
Well, I mean, they're not really different from yours, but I think that what it really helps to understand how sharp LaRouche's February 15th turn on this was and what he's trying to make you understand. I referenced it earlier that the chief economist of the IMF and another IMF economist published a paper in which it was said quite bluntly, we were wrong about the austerity that we proposed and imposed and insisted on for the countries which have gotten these so-called bailouts from the ECB, Portugal, Greece, Spain, Ireland, Italy. We were wrong about these. The policies of austerity that we imposed made their debts worse rather than making them better. We had the wrong calculations in our model. They made their debts worse, and they therefore required more austerity. And we hadn't anticipated this. We didn't see it coming. So we really were, and you would think, but you'd be wrong. Because accompanied with that, the IMF at the same time demanded additional austerity, in particular from Greece, that has increased the demands for even what had already, even the bailout loans for the banks that had already been agreed on, and imposed something still worse on Ireland, increased its demands for austerity on Portugal. In other words, they made it crystal clear that the purpose of that what they were getting at in that policy paper by the chief economist was not that they were going to change their policy, but that they were circulating among themselves the parameters of what they were doing, which is driving people into a level of austerity which causes the population to die, starting with the older people, the less healthy people, and which completely eliminates the useful prospects of the young by subjecting them to 50 and 60 and 70% unemployment rates, to where they disappear from the labor force entirely and they just somehow try to fend for themselves on the streets. This was intended by the IMF. And this kind of paper is simply really an IMF report saying this is how it's gone so far. Not exactly, we didn't have the numbers right, but this is how it's gone so far. And then they double down on it. And, it can mean nothing else than that the British financial elite, which is behind the IMF and in it, and the financial elite allied with them, want the effects that are happening in Greece. They want the increase in the death rate, which has already occurred, the decrease in the birth rate, which has already occurred, the depopulation already going on in Greece and Portugal. They want that to happen. And that's what LaRouche is telling you is the next stage of the hyperinflation policy for all the countries, including the United States, unless, of course, it is stopped by Glass-Steagall. And I should just mention, we mean really stopped. If Glass-Steagall is passed, if Franklin Roosevelt's original Glass-Steagall Act is reenacted, then all of the purchases of securities that are taking place by the Federal Reserve from the banks for the printing of this money, all of those violate the Glass-Steagall Act instantly. They are purchases made from units of the bank which the Fed is not allowed to deal with at all under Glass-Steagall, and they are purchases of low-quality securities which may not be supported in any way by the federal government, according to the Glass-Steagall Act. That is, there's no federal insurance Glass-Steagall Act specifically forbids that low-quality securities of this type, including derivatives, can be transferred onto a federally insured unit of a bank and therefore potentially bought by the Federal Reserve. So it's all illegal and it all stops instantly. In fact, it could be reversed. What's already a chunk of what's already been done could be reversed. And that's another thing that's we are sometimes discussing with people on the Hill.
Well, and what that would mean then is that the banks have to make a choice if they wish to be protected under federal insurance regulations, then they would have to give up the investment, the speculative portfolios. And then, of course, the question, when you talked earlier about it's a reorganization, not just a regulation, the question of what happens to investment banks that are sitting there with huge leverage, holding on to assets which are nowhere close to their face value, even though they're keeping them at face value on their books, this is going to make the collapse of Enron look like a long-distance race. I mean, it'll happen virtually instantly.
That's right. And remember what I was describing before about the asset books of the biggest banks. The average American may think of them as commercial banks, but their loans are now no more than 30 to 40% of their portfolios, and the rest are securities which the Fed is supporting in this way and will have to stop immediately supporting in this way. And then the cash that they're getting from the Fed, which they're saving, a great deal of that is going to disappear just like that. That's the other thing that Lynn's warning is very clear. A great deal of what appears to be credit, oh, if we could only get it, right? If they would only lend it, is the way people talk about it, economists talk about it. A great deal of that you can stop talking about if they would only lend it, because it will be gone. It will be wiped out. And the credit to replace it will immediately come from the national credit measures that the government has to take.
Well, that brings me to the point I wanted to end the program with, which is that we had, in a sense, a gift from the heavens last week with the meteorite that struck Siberia, and it's not a gift for the people who were injured, but it did force a recognition of something that was unique to the original idea and intent of the Strategic Defense Initiative of Lyndon LaRouche, which was that this was not merely a military defense measure, but was actually premised on the whole idea of bringing online new physical principles, which have implications far beyond merely military anti-nuclear missile technologies. And this was brought up by Dmitry Rogozin, who's now a deputy prime minister in Russia, who's been tasked to push forward this idea of a strategic defense of the Earth. Now, we've seen the destruction of the original SDI program, going back to the role of Henry Kissinger, some of the Democrats in the Senate at the time, and then, of course, George Herbert Walker Bush. When you talk about, and I know you're involved in this also, when you bring up the SDE now, clearly there's been a shift in the thinking because of these events of last Friday, a week ago last Friday.
Oh, definitely. You could talk more about it from the European side. It seems that the European Space Agency in particular has had, you've seen quite a number of things coming from the European Space Agency just in a few days. Let's get going. Let's get telescopes built and up and covering the whole night sky every night all the time. Let's see these things. Let's have 3-4 months warning is what they're talking about. From the Russian side, the proposals which had already been made by Dmitry Rogozin were made again to the Russian government for implementation, to the prime minister in person for implementation. That is, that Russia send up the flag of a whole series, globe covering or near Earth space covering a series of satellite telescopes of all different wavelengths and different capabilities, and the aim to place satellites in orbit around around Mars, potentially around, potentially closer into the sun, as well as further out, so that we triangulate and we see these objects. That's only the start. But, you know, those things are, those proposals have really been given a tremendous platform by what happened over Chelyabinsk. And here, many people may not understand that if NASA had the same budget today that it was, that it had when it was performing miracles in the 1960s, when we went to the moon and did the other things then, that budget would be $150 billion. Instead, it's only $18 billion. So there is an immense gap between what NASA could and should be doing for all humanity and for our economy and what it is actually able to do at this
level. And this gets at the austerity question, because here's the case where someone is arguing, you know, they're fighting over tens of millions of dollars in cuts and shaving a little here and a little there, when in fact the larger budget that you mentioned, $150 billion, which would seem to be a budget breaker from the kind of discussions you hear on the blab shows and from the politicians, that actually would trigger a much greater growth of physical production.
Yeah, it would spin off as it did then. Tremendous technological progress and productivity increase throughout the economy, really. And at the same time, we could get back in business with the other major space powers, which now have come to include China, potentially India and South Korea, potentially other countries, definitely Russia, obviously, which has made this proposal. We could get back into the business of that collaboration to really protect the Earth from what everybody suddenly recognizes. It's not just a few people crying wolf. Everybody suddenly recognizes with these two near misses in one day, or one actual hit and one near miss of an astronaut in the same day, that we are threatened. We, the whole human race, all of human civilization on this Earth, are threatened with what, with a repeat of what has happened before in the history of the Earth, but before we were here. If it happens again, we could be wiped out completely and never progress anywhere in the solar system or anywhere else and simply cease to be. So we have to be able to protect ourselves as a human species from this, and we're a long, long, long way from, I mean, we're a long way from even detecting all the potential threats of this sort that we just saw, let alone deflecting after detecting. Deflecting is a whole other huge enterprise, a great enterprise for the human race to be able to actually intersect what's coming at us, and in various ways, not necessarily only by explosive means, in various ways, to deflect them away so that they don't actually impact the Earth. This is this will have many, many, many other benefits of the common aims of humanity besides doing this, but we really have to do it.
Well, this came up in the there was just the UN conference in Vienna the last 9 days, where this is where some of the European Space Agency comments came from. But one of the reports that I saw said that they're going to announce a mission statement in about 2 months, but they're talking about not even having the observational platforms until 2020. And, you know, you begin to get a sense of the difference between the crash program approach that John Kennedy took when he first announced the moon program, and this idea today of, even with the sense of heightened urgency, there's almost a foot dragging saying, well, we really can't get it up any quicker, so let's just hope we don't get hit by another surprise between now and 2020.
We have to do again in this regard, and this time with the positive participation from the Russian side rather than the opposition, we have to do what we did again with the Strategic Defense Initiative 35 years ago, really, when we I say Lyndon LaRouche and what is now LaRouche PAC, when we started campaigning with mass pamphlets in the later 70s for a beam
Sputnik
weapon.
Sputnik of the 80s.
Yeah, for the beam weapon defenses against our own, that is human-designed threats, the intercontinental nuclear explosive devices and intercontinental ballistic missiles. But now the frontier of the threat has been made pretty clear that it's the bombardment of Earth from beyond. And many of these asteroids are right in our orbit. People, you know, we learn in school they're up in the in between Mars and Jupiter in the asteroid belt. That's nice. They are there. But they're in a lot of other places, and a lot of them, what they call near-Earth objects, are pretty much tracking us very near our orbit and just weaving in and out of it, like the asteroid that went by last week. And, you know, the larger of them we can see, the smaller of them we don't know are there, or we don't know where they are, but we know they are there, and that there are thousands and thousands of potential impacts there that we have to protect ourselves from. So that's why strategic defense of Earth, as, again, as we got Reagan to say, a common effort of the United States and Russia and the other major space powers, a strategic defense of Earth against this threat will also produce many, many other benefits. So on March 27th, 4 days after the anniversary, we're going to be holding a conference on this subject, which will go into the whole thing, including what we used to call back then the spinoffs and what else can happen. So that's going to shift the situation.
Well, that's a conference that our supporters can attend. We'll be getting more information out on that. Watch on the website, but March 27th will be the conference commemorating the 30th anniversary of Ronald Reagan's speech endorsing the Strategic Defense Initiative. And, Paul, that actually does bring us to a kind of closure, because we're facing a human threat, that of hyperinflation, which does carry with it almost a near extinction of the human race if it's not addressed. At the same time, we have the war danger, which is run largely by the same people who are responsible for this collapsed economy. But the solution, Glass-Steagall, a credit policy, and the kind of technological advances implicit in the North American Water and Power Alliance 21 and the SDE, gives us the way out. So in that sense, Lyndon LaRouche's warning is a call to action, and it does give us an opportunity to have something even more intense than we had in the 80s right now, because that's what it's going to take, because the population has gone backwards since then.
Yes, he was saying quite clearly on February 15th in that shocking webcast, we're not just observing a process by which hyperinflation is taking off as if we were armchair economists. We have a path to get out of it, to stop it. We also have to understand where that other path leads. And on that basis, we take action and we choose the path that is going to lead to the survival and benefit of the human species. But the action is the prominent thing, and you have to know where these paths lead in order to take it.
Well, I would encourage our listeners to go back to the webcast from February 15th and also the one from last night, which is now archived, and where LaRouche elaborates a little bit more some of the themes we've been discussing today. This is the time where it's no longer acceptable to sit back and whine and complain. We need a population, at least a significant minority of the population, thinking and acting. And, Paul, I'd like to thank you for joining us today and for bringing your insights to our listeners. And there's more of this. You can pick it up on LaRouchePAC.com. I just noticed there was a presentation by Dennis Small that was just posted today on the hyperinflation question. So LaRouchePAC.com, organize for the Glass-Steagall mobilization, and also set aside on your calendar March 27th, come to Washington to the conference on the strategic defense of Earth. So, Paul, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. It was fun.
Okay, and be with us next Saturday, 3 p.m. Eastern, when we'll have another edition of The LaRouche Show.